It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod's Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Welcome to another episode of Alaska Tracks, where we listen to recorded interviews with veteran Alaskan outdoorsmen and women. I'm your host, Randy Zarnke. Today's featured guest is Al Franzman. Al worked on the Kenai as a wildlife veterinarian for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Al's work ethic and upbeat attitude made him a success in this role. Al later began a career as a wildlife consultant. His expertise was in constant demand in exotic locales around the world. Throughout his life, Al recalls how hunting and fishing served as a focus for his life. He shares his passions with his son and grandson at every opportunity. In this first segment, Al describes his youth in Ohio, his formal education, and a career transition which brought him to Alaska.
I grew up in Midwest Ohio, to be exact. Spent all my growing years on a farm. I had a great uncle, and this was in Ohio. In Ohio, in those days, I mean, what he had, rabbit, a few pheasants, some quail, not much. But this guy lived outdoors. He lived to hunt. I know now he didn't pay any attention to what the regulations, you know, he wanted to hunt rabbits. He shot rabbits, and if there was a lot of them to shoot, he shot a lot of them. I didn't know that as a kid, but I just was fascinated with this guy. My parents would go there, and he always have some rabbit skinned out or something for him. Mom liked to make hoss and pfeffer. I just loved to listen to his stories. That was my first introduction to the thought about hunting and that's something that I really wanted to do. But of course, I was just a little guy. My other uncle, he just liked to hunt and he liked guns. He had really good guns and he took good care of them and introduced me to quality rifles and handguns. But he just liked to shoot and he liked to hunt and introduced me to that. And that's when I first started. My first gun was a 22 410 over and under. I think maybe every kid in that era, that was his first gun. You know, it was a do everything, you know. And it was a nice little gun and pottered around with that for a number of years. Then I realized I needed more than that 410 single shot to really have a lot of fun shooting rabbits and pheasants. And I ended up buying me an Ithaca 37 12 gauge, and I still have it. It's my grandson's now. Got a lot of history with that one. Spent a lot of time in the field, and I love that gun. And I've never had a shotgun that I like. I've got an over and under Belgian with them, those fancy ones. Can't think of the name of them. I don't like it. It's supposed to be a really good gun, but I had that one gun that was the best and the one that I really liked the most. While I was practicing veterinary medicine, I didn't have much time to do anything. I was a single man practice. Had no time, even for my kids. That's another reason I had to change some direction. But I did take vacations every year. I took 2 weeks off and had another guy come in and work the practice for me. Every one of those trips was going west to go hunting. First one was an elk trip in the Bob Marshall area. Just great. It was all part of that getting me into the do something with wildlife. I just enjoyed it so much. And then pronghorns and muleys in Wyoming, black bear. With the family, these are Murphy brothers and the old man. The Murphy brothers were the name of the outfitter from Evander, Montana. Some of the best in the business at that time. They're no longer doing a world of experience in that part of the country and in hunting. The place where we had our camp was called Murphy's Flats. I mean, you know, they've been there forever. The old man came to that country as a teamster driving a wagon, hauling stuff, and he fell in love with Evander and settled in and started ranching and whatnot, and then doing this outfitting business. And the neatest thing about that trip, besides just being great country, and except for the saddle horses, all the packing horses were mules. We were the last trip in, which meant that they had to take in extra pack animals to bring the camp out. And there were three strings of 10 mules, and some of the most beautiful mules. It was a sight to behold.
Felt like you'd moved back in time about 100 years.
Yeah, it really was. Well, there were two of us on that trip, both from Ohio, my good friend all through high school. That trip convinced us both. He moved west, too. After one of these hunting trips, and I was telling this young kid that was wanting to be a veterinarian, he was in college, in pre-vet. When he got a chance, he'd always ride with me and make calls. God, I went on and on about this hunting thing, and one day he brought me this book, Our Wildlife Legacy. It was that book where I learned about wildlife management. what the purpose is. Just fascinating. I couldn't stop reading the thing. And in this book, it also explained these wildlife research units, which were all around the state, and their objective was to train people in wildlife management, wildlife research. And that's when I started writing to those units. Here I am. I want to get involved in wildlife. I have this veterinary background. I didn't get many responses from any of them, except from Idaho. Morris Hornlicker wrote me a real nice letter. Said he'd like for me to come out. Man, I couldn't get my tickets fast enough. And my wife is aware, you know, that I'm thinking along these lines, but I don't think she thought things were going to happen. So I head out to Idaho. I meet with him in the morning. By the afternoon, he's got me a scholarship lined up, National Wildlife Federation's fellowship. I called home. I said, how would you like to think about moving to Idaho? I can get into school next fall. They accepted into the wildlife program. And the other thing that they did, they looked at all my credits and they said, we can put you directly into a PhD program because of what the stuff I had in agriculture and pre-vet, and got just too good a thing to miss. And big pause on the phone. I said, we're going to move to Idaho. And she's gone along with it all. And of course, I could never have done the things I've done without someone like that. And, you know, all those overseas junkets, fortunately, nearly every one of them, she was able to go with me. It just even made it that much better. But that Durwood Allen book, never heard anybody else that talked too much about that. But that book, it just came to me at the right period of time. I'd send stuff up here, all the paperwork, and never even got responses, didn't hear anything. And because I was working on bighorn sheep in Idaho for my doctorate degree, I went to one of the first sheep meetings. It was in Colorado, and he gave a paper there, and I met Lyman Nichols. Lyman, I said, what do you got to do to get on up in Alaska? I said, God, these guys, they never respond to anything. Oh, he said, no problem. Said, just send your application to me, and I'll see if it gets to the right guy. And he did. The right guy was Bob Roush. And he was a statewide moose guy. This was been in 1970, 71. So anyway, I met Roush at the North American meeting in Portland and sort of had a little interview. And at that time, they were just starting the Moose Research Center. Even before they knew me, they thought it would be ideal to have a veterinarian on board. And they actually hired a guy from Utah. He was up here. He and Art Bradley were doing a survey of the pens, and they crashed, and both of them were killed. That's how things happen for you, and I just came along right soon after that, and that's how I got up here. We're at the Moose Research Center. A thing happened relating to me coming up here that was sort of an interesting quirk. I told Roush down in Portland that I would come. He says, well, I can't guarantee that we can get you on right away, but he said, if you come up, that's the first step. You've got to be there. That's when Egan was governor, and he didn't like hiring anybody out of the state, so it was something he just didn't tolerate. So I said, that's fine. I'll take that chance. I'll come on up. I came up by myself. But prior to that, I had written, a guy named Graham Cawley was working with Himalayan tar in New Zealand, and he was looking for a postdoc to work with on that project. God, it just sounded so great because he's a real astute individual, and I thought it was a great opportunity, so I applied for that. And I was supposed to know, like, in mid-September. Well, I didn't hear anything, so I thought, well, it's over with. So in the meantime, I meet Roush, and I give him my word that I'll come up. God, I no sooner did that, and I get this letter from the embassy in San Francisco saying, please report to so-and-so at such a time, you've been accepted to have for a postdoc with. So I had to write. And they apologized for not having that information to me on time, but I'd already obligated myself up here. And then when I got up here, things turned really sour as far as employment. The only thing they could do, they were putting me on temporary appointment for 6 months. That's fine, I can do that. And they said, well, I still can. I mean, how about another 6 months? God, I got a family. What's going to be the deal? They said, he's got his rough up about something down there. We're going to have a hard time running this through. So I did another 6 months. That's why I've got to give credit to him, because he really worked. We both gave. I obligated my time and said I would be willing to come here, not with a job per se, but with that opportunity to have a job. And then he would do what he could to get me on. Well, it worked. Finally did get me on. Finally got to where I really wanted to be. Enjoyed veterinary medicine, enjoyed the practice, and I benefited from the fact that I had that training and it fit in with what I was doing at the Moose Research Center. But the thing that I ended up doing that was the most satisfactory was just doing research projects, doing actually designing and promoting and funding and getting projects complete. So I did that for 15 years out at the Moose Research Center. The thing that made it really a super experience for me was that two things happened in that era. And one of them was the development of telemetry equipment that was just coming on board. And the other one was immobilization drugs were improving and equipment. Everything came along about that time. Well, both these things fit into my background, and so I ended up doing a lot of work testing drugs on different critters. And because of that, I got to work all over the state on different animals and on different projects. Fortunately, Charles Schneider, who was a supervisor, is one of these guys that said, I'll let you know when you do something wrong. Just do your thing. And sort of gave me a free hand. And when these types of things came up, guys wanted me to be on the project with them, I had a free hand to do it. It was a wonderful experience. There were a lot of crazy things that happened during the early days of immobilizing animals because the drugs were evolving. They weren't good at all yet. They were just getting there. But that was a lot of fun.
You had a chance to travel around the state, work with all the different species?
Just about everything, you know, from foxes to polar bears, deer in the southeast, on the ice in the north. Things that I could never, ever have afforded to do on my own, to see and experience those kind of places and things. So I've just been blessed with that opportunity and this work.
Alaska Tracks. In this next segment, Al explains some of his work in India and Africa, as well as his term on the game board here in Alaska.
When I retired, I never figured I ever retired, but when I shifted gears again, I focused on doing the same type of thing, that is working with wildlife, and primarily in capture and translocation operations, more on a worldwide basis. Again, opportunity, timing all came together because it was an era when countries were beginning to recognize that they needed to do things with their wildlands, and most of them had been overrun and not protected, and there weren't any management programs. It was just sort of a helter-skelter. And my first introduction to that was in India, and it all related to Project Tiger. I wasn't a tiger expert or anything, but Project Tiger was more than just tigers. Through Project Tiger, they established early on 15 areas in India that they just set aside as preserves. They took the people out, as only a place like that could do. I don't think in today's world they could even do it there. But anyway, Indira Gandhi was able to do that. They established these 15 tiger preserves. They were getting so much pressure from the international community because tigers were going down the tubes, and there wasn't any kind of a program in India at all. And that was the only place where there were any great numbers of them. So she stepped in to do that.
How large were the individual preserves?
There are some that are quite small and obviated them ever being very useful. This is something they learned in the process. There are some that were large enough that they could have a full food base system, a major predator-prey ecosystem that would allow tigers to do well. But they had to have a food base, of course, too. And that's something that they didn't understand at first. They thought they'd just make preserves and there were tigers there and everything, and that was all they needed to do. Well, pretty soon realized they were in trouble with this. In order to help resolve that, they called a workshop. It was at Kanha Park in India, and it was 6 weeks, all paid for by the Indian government, and they brought over, I think there was 22 of us from the States, each of us having a different area of expertise. Then I was brought in on the capture and immobilization aspect of it. And we had this workshop, and our counterparts were Indian foresters. They had no wildlife people. They had no wildlife programs. And the only thing that they knew about wildlife is that they had wildlife in the woods. I mean, that's just about the extent of it. The obvious recommendation from this workshop was that India needed to train wildlife biologists. And we all left there thinking, yeah, it'll be a cold day in hell when that happens, because the way things work over there, things just never get done. Much to our surprise, within 6 months, Indira Gandhi officially established the Wildlife Institute of India. Within a year, they had the thing under construction. Following that, this core group was at this workshop. Were brought over maybe one or two at a time to work with your Indian counterpart, who was going to be a staff person at this institute to train Indians. So naturally, my counterpart was a young Indian veterinarian who had an interest and some experience with zoo animals. And he got his interest in wildlife from that. But he was a very astute young fellow and took to everything very quickly. So I was over there, I think, 4 or 5 different times in different periods working with him, helping him establish the curriculum and just getting things going and working with in what was called the Wildlife Health Program there in India. And then I got to work with, in that program, I got to meet a guy named John Sale, who was from Britain and had worked with the United Nations in their forestry and wildlife segment and spent most of his career in Africa. Then he got me involved and introduced into the United Nations programs, and I had several consultancies through that with him. One of them was translocating rhinos from Nepal back into India. And again, this is all tied in with Project Tiger, because they had the land all of a sudden, and then once they determined historically what types of critters were there and could be there, then it began to be a reintroduction program, reintroducing these things into these areas. And rhinos was a big high profile because they were looking for acceptance in the world community, really what it amounted to as much as anything. And then through John Sale, I got to work in Africa. This wasn't a capture translocation thing. It was working with elephant depredations in Zimbabwe. And I've been back there a couple times on other projects as well. I worked in Irian Jaya, which is part of Indonesia now. It used to be old Dutch New Guinea. So that was a deer project. That was World Wildlife Fund. And you get into this thing, you know, it didn't really plan any of this kind of stuff. It just sort of fell together. And once you do some of this, then word gets out and you become somebody that
is willing to go and is going to be a valuable part of the team once you get there.
I hope so. But anyway, I was lucky enough to get to do that. So I've had a lot of that kind of thing with wildlife. In today's world, that's networking. What I was experienced was networking. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just sort of how things sort of fall together when you're available at the right place. And then I made that horrible mistake of getting on the board of game for Alaska. I didn't think it was, because they told me, so, well, you only meet 4 times a year, it's no big deal. I said, well, that's fine, I can work project around that. If you remember, my period on a board of game was when the wolf thing came to another major high-profile head. The wolf management plan had just been put together, and this was like night and day. This is 24/7. Somebody was on the phone all the time. Your mailbox was full of all kinds of documentation. As a result of that period of time, which was very intense and very, very difficult as far as time constraints on me, I turned down several opportunities to do things that I would have really liked to have done, but I had made an obligation to serve on this board. It's not something you can not be there. So I got out of the loop, and there are other people. I'm not the only guy that can do that kind of stuff.
What years were you on the board?
I think 91 to 94.
In this next segment, Al shares memories of some of his favorite moose hunting adventures.
How about on the moose side? Is there one particular trip that sticks out in your mind?
Almost all the moose hunting I've done has been here on the Kenai. The hunt that my son got his first moose was great. One really big moose that he shot. We went in on the part of the Swanson River system, but it's out by Swan Lake. And there's a series of about 6 lakes. And from those, you can get into places where people can't fly in there. But it's a job getting in. You got all those portages. So we decided we'd do this. It was beautiful. The weather was sunny and bright and chilly and nice at night. Anyway, we got in there to the place where we were going to set up camp. And it was still light, getting a little dark, though light enough. I said, Carl, let's just go on up over the hill here and have a look-see. And there's a great big rock. We'd been there before, a huge big boulder that was out there, and we just headed for that, climbed up on that thing. And I looked down there, and I sort of squeezed down there, and I mean, it was just that big a bull that there was no mistaking it. And he says, is it legal? Yes, shoot it. So he shot it. But then, God, you know, here we are. The end of the day, and we just busted our butts getting in there and hadn't even set up camp. And we had a down moose.
So you had to gut him and set up camp.
Get something to eat. It was sort of a frantic evening, but wonderful time because, hell, you got this beautiful animal and everything was just as it should be. It probably should have been the next day, you know, it would have been a little bit better. But then the real problem came because all we had was a 17-foot Grumman lightweight canoe. And we're thinking, all these portages. We'd taken one moose back there once before, but we were with another guy and we had two canoes. We just the two of us in this one canoe. Well, we managed to do it, but what was really spooky is we'd loaded up as much as we could possibly load it up. We were just about an inch of freeboard on the sides in that canoe, and God, Carl, don't sneeze. And we stayed right along the edge of all these lakes, you know. We didn't want to get out very far in any of them. It took us 2.5 days just getting that out of there. But that reminds me of a story that it's not related to hunting, it's related to capture and mobilization. And this is down in Yakutat. Chris Smith was down there at that time. He was a biologist. And we were working at what they call the forelands down there, and we were tagging moose, and Chuck Schwartz went down with me and Chris Smith. To work with me was a young guy out of Juneau who was a temporary, had never done anything like this before in his life. We were working two crews, two guys work on the moose and turn it loose, and the chopper would go get the other guys, you know, go back and forth, back and forth. We were working on this one cow, was in a stand of aspens. She defied driving her out. She just wasn't having anything of it, and boy, her old bristles were up on her back and her ears back and just looking up at us. You could just hear her cussing, you know. We could not get her driven out of there. So we decided, well, let's just let her sit. She maybe just work her way out and we'll go look around. We found another, and no, we didn't find another moose right away. I said, well, let's go back and see where next she is. She's still in there. This time she did come out, and we did manage to get her immobilized and tagged. Everything went just fine the way it's supposed to go. Next day, I'm out with this young guy, and he's a real neat kid, but he's really a greenhorn. We go back to this same area, and there was a pretty large open area in that general area where we were the day before. And we'd gotten a moose down, and she wandered off and got right in the middle of this great big field, and then she went down. Chopper pilot dropped us off. He says, I got to get fuel. It's okay to drop you right here. I said, oh, yeah, she's just out there in the field. So he and I start walking out there and carrying her bag. I hear a strange noise behind me. Jeez, I look around. Here comes this cow. Same one, same number, right after us. And she hit me first and just ran over me, knocked me down. I told the kid, I said, head for the trees, head for the trees. Well, God, we were almost as far away from the trees as we were from the moose. We were about halfway out there. Well, before he could even think about doing anything, she went after him, knocked him down. She actually went after each of us twice before we could manage to get to the cow that was down. She just wouldn't have anything to do with us. We were just hunkered under that cow that was immobilized, but she wouldn't leave. And I remembered I had my handheld two-way radio, so I thought I'd call the other crew, see if we could reach him. No answer, nothing. But hit the squelch. Jesus, she just had a conniption when she heard that. Something about that noise just set her off. And she just took out of there and never saw her again. But that poor kid, I'll tell you what, he was petrified, and he wanted no more of this. He wanted to go home. So we had to send him home and wait till he got somebody else out of Juneau to help. We were both lucky. When I was sitting there, I think the second time I got knocked down, my only thoughts in my mind were, where's the nearest hospital? Because that's where I'm going to end up, and I don't know where in the heck they're going to take us. But I just figured we'd have it. She was just going to do us in. For some reason, she didn't strike, and I'll never understand that. She could have done a lot of damage with her hooves instead of just sort of running. And that's the same thing that bull did to Carl. And that was the only times I've ever had any close encounter with a moose. That's what's happened. I never was struck. I've never been able to explain why that happened, but fortunately it did. Yeah, there's a lot of potential danger in working with these critters.
In this last segment, Al relates his hunting legacy and concerns for the future of hunting.
One thing I haven't given up on, and that's my hunting. This morning I was out at my son's. We're packing for a hunting trip. I'm going up around Chicken, and this will be three generations of it. It'll be my first time my grandson is old enough. He'll be turning 13 on this hunt. It'll be his first major big game hunt. A moose and a caribou may be available. That's primarily moose. Couldn't have been a better life. Couldn't have designed it any better, and I've been just really fortunate. I'm not going to dwell on that too much, but what I really am concerned about, what I really think is problematic, and this is reinforced with my experience on the Board of Game, is how the majority of the people in this country don't have a clue as to what experiences in the natural world are about, and experiences are best done, to me, through hunting, fishing, and trapping. And the input into this now is really scary. And I travel enough outside to know that, and you know, I'm talking about relatives and cousins, they've been so urbanized. Hardly any of them have come off of a farm, which I think is a truly benefit to somebody if they're lucky enough to have that experience. Then they can relate easier to these things, but the people today, I don't know where we're going to go with this. I feel I'm an evolutionary dead end because there's so few people that I talk to that I respect and are no dummies that just don't get it as far as what hunting is all about. That really concerns me. I don't know what to do about it. I guess that's the biggest problem. One-on-one, you can only influence a few people. So I guess if I can just do it with my family, I'll have to be satisfied with that.
That's all for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to these stories from a well-known and successful wildlife vet with Fish and Game. Join us again next week when we hear from another veteran outdoorsman.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Rod Saw Shop. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.